And if we can create more unified ideas and concepts and sense of direction at the local level, that then bubbles up through all of the systems that go on. It all comes down to the grassroots. It all comes down to how can we have a positive effect on people's daily lives and use that positive effect to then mobilize people to larger, more abstract concepts, right? So,
podcast De Bieb is Meer gaat op zoek naar de toekomst van openbare bibliotheken en hoe zij bijdragen aan de maatschappelijke uitdagingen van deze tijd. Met nieuws uit de sector, spraakmakende gasten en verrassende thema's word je meegenomen in de wereld van leesbevordering, digitaal burgerschap en participatie. De Bieb is Meer is een initiatief van Matt Gubbels die jou wil informeren en inspireren. Hij gelooft in de kracht van podcasting en het verhaal van de bibliotheek.
Welkom bij deze speciale aflevering van podcast De Bieb is Meer. Vorig jaar hadden Irene Harmsen en ik het grote genoegen om bibliotheekgoeroe David Lenkes uitgebreid te interviewen over zijn bijzondere visie op het bibliotheekwerk. In ongeveer 9 maanden tijd is er het een en ander veranderd op het wereldtoneel en ontkomen we niet aan de indruk dat het presidentschap van Donald Trump daar een behoorlijk aandeel in heeft. Nu ook het bibliotheekwerk in de Verenigde Staten behoorlijk onder vuur lijkt te liggen, leek het ons meer dan relevant om met David de ontwikkelingen proberen te duiden. En daarom hebben we contact met David en vervolgen we deze podcast in het Engels.
David, welcome back to the Netherlands. With what feeling did you leave our country last year?
Yeah, in the summer, it was an amazing trip. And I always leave the Netherlands very energized and full of good questions. This last time I got to actually spend some time thanking to VOB and visiting and traveling around and had a great time with y'all. And what I left was, you know, in 10 years, the Netherlands are going to have the best public libraries in the world and no librarians working in them. And I thought that that was an interesting paradox because of how librarians get defined currently. So that got my brain going around and around and around. But it was a helpful confusion.
I'm really wondering, so what did you do with the confusion into your work then?
Yeah, so there's another manuscript that's going to be put out here really soon on a series of lectures, calling it a triptych, which an artist like three pictures on a theme, that really looks at the idea of needing to redefine in the Netherlands how we define librarians, but also, and we talked about this a bit during June, but also in the United States, how we have to rethink what is our library science education doing, right? How is it that I've always thought of library science education as a way of pushing forward a field, but it may very well be something that's pulling everyone to some lesser average. Yeah. And so, yes, thinking a lot about how we can, really the big push is how we can have a more expansive definition of what a librarian is.
And therefore, David, the main reason for getting in touch with you again are the developments in the United States. I think it's quite an understatement to say that things have changed dramatically because we are at a distance. We would like you to dive a little bit deeper in the measures that have come across and have impacted libraries or are going to impact libraries in the future. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What are the facts?
So the facts are that libraries, public and school in particular, have been under attack in regions of the country since the pandemic. And the pandemic really was a shifting moment when there was a sort of empowered voices and parents' rights and looking at different things. And that's when the idea of book banning and what was being allowed in libraries and access for children, that's where it really began. So that's been ongoing. However, with the new Trump administration taking up the residence in the middle of January, it has been a roller coaster ride of executive orders and pronouncements. Our national Congress has really stepped back and allowed the president to do a lot of restructuring of the federal government, firing of the federal government, shifts and changes. So that's the larger context. Specifically to libraries at the federal level, we've seen a couple of moves, but two that are noteworthy, right? We've seen, for example, things like the National Agricultural Library has reduced its budget and can't necessarily keep its own journals and things of that nature. But the big ones were first the firing of the National Archivist and putting a loyalist and not anyone with any sort of archival or cultural heritage background in that position. And that was really seen as a punitive act for the whole set of prosecutions that had happened previously. And then more recently, the focus, if you will, on the Institute for Museum and Library Services. So the Institute for Museum and Library Services is a tiny, tiny agency in the federal area.
How many people are working there? Because we read on the LinkedIn pages that it was supposed to be closed, but you wrote on your column that it's not closing, but it's just changing in focus.
Right. And so the broad perspective is that Congress had started over the past 30 years, and probably before that, to set up independent agencies, like sort of not-for-profit and institutes that were federal, but almost at an arm's length. So for example, the director of these agencies normally was nominated to things like 6 years and 10-year terms that would overlap potential administrations. Trump and the administration do not like these independent agencies, and for lots of different reasons want to take control of them, IMLS being one. So there was an executive order specifically around IMLS. And I should be clear, an executive order in the U.S. federal system is a lot like a statement of purpose and not anything like a law. Only Congress passes laws and presidents can veto them. So everything that's really happened to this point, pronouncements about diversity, equity, inclusion, National Archives, et cetera, are by this sort of royal fiat, which technically has no legal strength, legal standing, and which is interesting. And so, for example, when he put an executive order around IMLS, which is kind of like the executive branch should do this, it wasn't closing it. It was stopping anything that wasn't legislated. In other words, anything that Congress told it to do was off limits, which is everything that they do. So he couldn't really necessarily just eliminate this with a wave of a hand. So what they did was they went in and they created a new director. There was an interim director before. This person is an employment lawyer with connections to a political party. He's now the director. And what we were expecting was a huge wave of layoffs, as we've seen in other parts of the federal agency. That didn't happen as well, but we're talking about, I don't even know the accurate number, but it's got to be in the scale of 50 people, right? So it's not like hundreds and hundreds. So it wasn't necessarily the worry that they're going to eliminate IMLS, though that's a lot of the language you see, and there was sort of this assumption. It's much more concerning that the new director said that we were going to use the agency and bring it in line with this sort of political agenda, patriotism and American exceptionalism and all this wonderful stuff. And so the question will be, through its grant programs and et cetera, will it be, supporting an ideological view as opposed to what it's done in the past? And so that's troublesome, not that it's eliminated, but that it's sort of recasting what it is. It's bringing it much more under the direct, I think the phrase was lockstep, meaning, in exact accordance with what the president wants to do. And so that's one thing. The other thing that people outside of the U.S. need to have a context, because it's a small thing, we don't have within the United States the equivalent of a Ministry of Culture. In fact, we don't have things like a National Library Law. The only thing we have is IMLS and then these state grants where some money will be sent to the states and then the states can do with it as they please. They're called block grants. And even so, by the time you get to your local library, very, 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 very little of that money comes from the federal level. Its budget is almost entirely local. Now, they do benefit from things like statewide licensing of databases, so they don't have to spend their own money to get those databases, training initiatives, research initiatives. But in terms of actual operations, there isn't a lot of federal money at stake here. But what money that does use helps our state libraries work, which is really important, and funds research in the area, which is very important for, well, academics like me, but continuing to do research and look at those research.
But it's still strange that, the whole issue is about sending an Institute of Museum and Library Services away. because everything is really divided, is organized well in each state, and taxpayers are giving the monies and it's getting divided as well. So I'm really wondering, why is the Trump administration so bashing education ministry and all kind of services who has done well related to culture and musea? Why is this going on?
Yeah. More, the other thing I didn't mention, which is maybe even more problematic in terms of federal libraries, is when Trump's administration looked at our Department of Education, one of the first things it did was it dismissed a whole suite of investigations around book banning in public schools. So there were a bunch of complaints from localities saying, you know, in our public school, primary and secondary school, we have these book removals. We feel that's against things like civil rights, that's against First Amendment. And the Department of Education was investigating several of those. And the first thing that happened was those were, nope. And not only did they stop the investigations, but they put out a press release talking about the hoax of book banning. So it was a sort of pretty clear signal that they were not going to stop or in any way be in stopping the idea of book banning at the local level. There's a lot of discussion, and one is, and you know, some of these are ideological, a lot of these are ideological, but that notion of what does government do? Our federal government is huge and it's costly. And that notion, so the first thing that's at least purported, and I don't disagree with it, rather, I don't disagree that this is a legitimate intention, not one that I share, is that we need to downsize government. Too many people working, costing too much stuff. So downsize, regardless of what it is, we're going to downsize everything and we're going to do it quickly and we're going to, you know, break things. And that was startling. And in fact, what we're seeing is that a lot of those attempts to just lay off a couple of 100,000 people, now the federal courts are saying not so fast, right? So our court system is in there slowing things down. The larger question about why, say, a Department of Education and why IMLS and libraries is the notion that what the states want to do versus what the federal want to do, right? So it's sort of provincial versus federal government. What's the right take and what's the right role? And current administration is slash and burn that, you know, the states should be doing a lot more of this, that we need to get government out of doing these functions, et cetera. There's also a real belief among some that people who work for the federal government are, in essence, bureaucrats and not necessarily that efficient. And the market, the free enterprise and private enterprise could do a lot of this more efficiently and faster and better and quicker. So that's a lot of the discussion that's going on. That's a lot of the rhetoric that's going on. There's a, you know, more political side of things, which is federal government workers tend to be Democratic. There are lots of not necessarily wanting to provide the same level of oversight and restraint of an executive branch that government has set up. And so education and libraries, I think at that federal level, are sort of caught in a big sweep. But what we are absolutely seeing at the state level that you may not hear about and see is things like privatizing our education. We call them voucher systems, taking taxpayer dollars, giving it back to people to pay for private education instead of funding our public schools. Book banning and the notion of who's allowed to book to ban a book and say what's allowed in our libraries, that's very much happening at the local level. And like I say, continuing and emboldened by these moves happening at the federal level.
Having put things in context, David, is it still right to say and to conclude that the public libraries in the United States are really on the fire?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just public libraries. One of the things that the federal government came up with was a list of words that are verboten, right? Like these are you're not allowed to have the word diversity and inclusion. And it's a huge list of words. And it is poorly applied. So, you'll find plenty of examples. But one of my favorite is taking down all the images that went with the first use of the atomic bomb during World War II. Because the plane that dropped the bomb was named the Enola Gay. And because it had the word gay in it, we took that down. And we see this in not across states. States do vary in terms of political ideology, but we certainly have seen this in Texas where there's just this keyword search on websites to find these terms and assume that when they find the terms, they are bad terms and they must be stopped. Stupid, stupid things. Like at the federal level, there was a grant that was sold. This is about creating transgender mice. And in fact, it was the idea of a transitive genetic usage, right? In other words, the trans part was a medical terminology, had nothing to do with gender, et cetera. And so this sort of stupid application of search and technology to try and identify terms and take them down quickly without much forethought, that's reckless. And so it's an attack on librarianship in that we know how to do this. You know, we don't want to do this at all, but we certainly know how to do it better in terms of how we work with terminology and classifications and such. And so, yes, there's an attack on public libraries.
How can a society guard against rising populism and hardening political polarization?
That is the question, right? The idea is, you know, there are enough people who voted for this and what they're doing is what they said they were going to do. And I think the very short but complex answer to that is we need to rebuild community. I mean, you know, the three of us are the community librarian gurus. This is not a surprising thing to hear. But what we've seen at the very local level when there are challenges, either at the public library or at the school library, is that it's usually a minority voice that is pushing for this separation. And the response from communities is normally very positive in the sense of they come and rally around the library and support what they're doing and inform what they're doing. And so the libraries in the most right-wing, far-right conservative parts of America have avoided these kinds of challenges because the librarians there are constantly having communication, discussion, and connection with the community about what's going on and what's happening. And so that way, when voices come, whether it's outside or minority voices within a community seek to do this thing, they already have a community ready to support what they're doing, support what the library is doing, and fend off these kinds of challenges. And so it comes back to the libraries that are doing well under these attacks are the ones that are connected and well integrated with the community, not those that have brilliant collections and beautiful buildings.
What role can the international organizations play in all these supporting of the librarians in your country?
Once again, I very much appreciate and the concept that the public libraries are under attack. So when you're under attack, it's not your best time to coolly and detachedly document, think through, and understand things. It's a matter of reacting and supporting. And because the good news is that our public libraries and our school libraries are hyper-local in their setting for support, but it also means that it's very, very hard to get an overall picture of what's happening, right? So when you make a phrase of public libraries are under attack in the United States, yes. Are they under attack in some place like Binghamton, New York? Probably not. Are they under attack, interestingly enough, in Portland, Oregon? Yeah, bits and pieces and dots. And so what I'm really encouraging, particularly the international community, is to, one, show solidarity support. This is not what libraries should be doing. We should be looking at these things, but also providing context and reflection. And so I wrote a brief essay on Don't Look Away, and that what I intend for that is, one, there are lessons to be learned by what's going on, but more importantly, we need someone outside of this mix to help document what's happening, to begin to record what this time period looked like. And from a perspective which is not in the middle of it, right? Every day I wake up and there's this huge list of things that happened in the federal government yesterday and all of them get me angry. That's not a great time for me to have space to think about those, right? And the intention, it is said, is to cause anxiety. The part of it is the anxiety is part of the functioning, to try and break down resistance, to try and break down mobilization against some of these efforts is just to keep pounding away at things to deal with. And so once again, you know, being in the Netherlands, being in South Korea, being in what have you, this is a good time to take a look. Also, from having conversations and spent time over in the Netherlands and with the Dutch, this is not impossible that it might happen elsewhere. And so learning lessons now, taking advantage of our crisis to understand and prevent one elsewhere is a good idea.
One of the things that you say, David, in your essay on LinkedIn is that libraries should not look away. And not looking away seems very easy and simple, but what do you mean by that? Not looking away?
what I mean by that is using your perspective, being slightly out of the situation, gives you a unique view that we within it don't have. Now, on some hands, you won't get all the lovely nuance of executive branches and federalization and all that. But on the other hand, you can see these clear pictures. And so one is to document, to not say, well, US is done, we'll move on. But to say there's value in investigating what's going on in this other country to our local setting. And so look away means to pay attention, but it also means to learn from and reflect. So that idea that it's not just a matter of documenting bits and pieces, it's also preserving a lot of information that's being pulled. There's a meme that goes around a lot in Facebook, for example, which is you do realize that pulling web pages off a site is equivalent to burning the books. And so where do those web pages go? One of the things that IMLS does is it produces a pretty significant and important data set on the state of libraries. Where are the, how many libraries, what setting, how much is their budget, what's their service? That data needs to be preserved, because what we've seen over in the Department of Education, there is an equivalent effort around public schools, performance, et cetera. And now that they have one staff member to run that data set, it's done. Capturing that data set, preserving that data set, maybe even helping to run that data set, and then bringing in people that can, like what we're doing now, discussing from people in the situation, and then bringing people elsewhere, bringing them in from when this happened in the UK under austerity budget and say, what did we learn there and how could that be applied? And what do we see through that lens when we look at the US? And so I think it's a matter of paying attention, providing assistance to librarians in their functions where possible, and providing perspective and reflection, not only back to the US, but internationally on how these things can happen.
I think we should do this as well. And that's also why we wanted to talk to you. But when we reflect on the whole context and situation, because of what's happening in your country, could happen here in Europe as well. We don't know. The words diversity and inclusion are still very modern, and a lot of people use that on the moment. But what we have to do is also to benefit the community. So when we talk and we read each other's columns and we listen to each other's podcast, how can we reach the community? Because the people who are going to the library, living in the villages, how do they know that we are worried or that we have these? How do we connect them?
That's a great question.
Because we need to reach them, because they listen to the news. Maybe they listen to Fox News. we don't know. Right, yeah. But how can we make sure that the community really has benefits from the conversations we have about the political system and the polarization at the moment?
So I saw a statement that came out the other day. I think it was from VOB, it was from the association, about attacks against a children's book and different children's book in a collection, right? And I said, oh, that sounds familiar. And it was from an organization of concerned parents. So like, oh, that sounds familiar. I remember when I was there this summer having a conversation with someone who was in the field. She was a consultant working in collection development. So she worked with different libraries on building their collections. And I said, when you look over the US and you look at these attacks, it seems like it's like these big communities and this big movement, and it's all Fox News, and it feels, and we want to have this lovely narrative that there's this big unified book banning force out there. I said, but it started with two people in a conversation. And it started with those two people being able to find 10 people in a community of 200,000 that would show up and act out and rally 200 people. Now, it usually doesn't go past the 200, but if they're loud and they show up and embarrass people, right? So let's have the head of the city government read a passage from this book, which is clearly offensive or sexual or what have you, and it's one page out of a 500-page book, right? This is a known tactic. And so what my point to her was, in the US, we had the same sense of, well, we have a community and communities love freedom of information. And we didn't pay attention to the 2 and 10 disgruntled people. And so it can happen very fast. It can happen where suddenly it turns into a movement and one piece of news empowers another community, and et cetera. And so my point of this is, what needs to start happening with the communities in the Netherlands today is a conversation about free access of freedom of information, is a discussion around our collections, right? We have this, what I very much picked up in the Netherlands is a service mentality of wanting to be a place and serve and bring communities together. But I think we also need to layer on top of that difficult conversations with the community. Now is the time to have a conversation about book banning and why we don't want to do that, as opposed to when you're in the middle of people trying to ban books. And so reaching out to a community and using, you know, US gets attention and we deserve all the attention negative that we're getting right now. Use that as a chance to start a conversation going, oh man, look at what's happening in America. How can we prevent that from happening here? Right. And so not looking away is also using us as a way of having your community say, I need you to pay attention to libraries in a different way than you have. Right. You paid attention in terms of the building and the facility and great service we can provide. I need you to also now understand that you have a responsibility here, which is to keep that free access and freedom of information. And while I think that is much more ingrained in the Dutch culture than it is in the US culture, it still needs care and feeding. It still needs to remind people of that principle and why that principle stands, because what we're seeing at the federal level with the current administration is a lot of things that we took for granted. This is how things work. This is how we assume they work. This is the culture that is built up. These are the standards of practice. We're just that. Culture and standards of practice, not law, not regulation, not creation. And when someone decides they're not going to play along with how the nice narrative goes, they can have a rapid, rapid effect upon a government, upon a country, that some will cheer on and some will be horrified by. But so great question. And the short answer is we need to engage our community in the conversation, particularly around the notion of collections, free access and public access.
I totally agree. And I think also this is very wise advice as well for us here in the Netherlands to keep on talking to our communities and to stay connected as well. But it also asks for libraries and especially for librarians not to be neutral. So we talked there about it in June in Noordorp. Do you agree that a lot of courage is needed just to talk, to have these conversations?
The only reason I'm hesitating on the word courage is I think it's part of our professional duty. And this comes back to how you prepare librarians and the professionalism and such. But it is courageous to engage in people who disagree. It is, I think, expected and should be expected to engage in the community conversation about this, because that's part of the job. Another reason to look at the United States is it has absolutely, we use the phrase in America about putting a lie to something. In other words, demonstrating that what we thought was the truth is not. And what we have seen is providing access and free and unfettered access of information to a democracy, to all the wonderful things, is not a neutral act. And you know, when someone comes in and says, I find this book offensive, I want it off the shelf, responding, well, you're just one voice in a larger community, is not a neutral act, right? You've just made a decision and the decision's not neutral. And a lot of neutrality up to this point has been used as a sort of assumed shield, like somehow we magically inherit it. But it is something that you are making decisions all the time. What you buy, what you sort, where you put it, what you highlight, what you allow in here. All of those are non-neutral decisions. And even though you've done it that way forever and no one's bothered you about it, that doesn't make it neutral somehow. That just makes it a current practice that can absolutely be challenged and changed. And so I think we need to have the conversations with the community before it takes courage.
Before it takes courage. Yeah.
Yeah.
And isn't it about all this about the moral compass?
And that's what I want. So this is an English thing. Within the research community might be a better way of saying it. We separate out moral from ethical, right? Moral is a sense of personal right and wrong, often connected into religious traditions, but not necessarily, versus ethical, which is sort of this process of externalizing these beliefs and codifying them, right? So we are an ethical and principled profession in that we have thought this through and made these kinds of statements. It is absolute about ethical clarity, but even more important is realizing you will never have a clear ethical decision. These will never be so beautifully obvious, right? When someone walks in and says, you have a book here. In this book, which is geared towards young adult readers, there is a sex act and it is explicit. It is not as clear cut as, well, you want to censor me, because there's a little part of you that goes, well, you know, maybe that isn't the right thing, et cetera. And how do we as a profession come and have that conversation versus depending on the individual at the time? But the individual at the time has to be prepared to do it. And so looping us all the way back, which is a librarian to me, isn't the person who holds the degree. It's the person that is equipped to have that exact conversation. How do we, in a principled and ethical way, provide information to a large community that can be in conflict and defend those decisions, right? And if we bring people in who are good at public marketing and public interface, but not this core of making community-based decisions around ethical quandaries, which happen every minute, then we do not have librarians, regardless of how we define them. And so how do we instill that into the field?
So how does everything going on now? Because if you say, well, we are in this situation, it's quite interesting is what's going to happen next, what kind of orders or degrees are next. We are in Europe, we're looking at what's happening, and all the papers every day is full written, and we read on LinkedIn and on Substack and Facebook, and all the social media is all about America, because we are looking at America and we say, well, we nearly lost our friends, you know?
Yeah.
This is what we feel here in Europe. And then we heard about this guy Vance, you know, he's just saying things about our continent, which we are totally not agree about. So what's going on? So is America going to be more crazy than it's like now? We don't know.
We don't know. And that's the problem. We don't know. It is truly mind-boggling that literally you can go from a pro-EU, pro-NATO, pro-Ukraine, pro-international monetary regime, et cetera, and literally overnight it can turn into isolation, xenophobia, and antagonism, and god awful.
It looked like an enemy from friends to
right,
enemy.
Finding common cause with Russia,
and then telling people that Putin is a very nice man. You know, I heard this interview, and we are shocked here about all these news, because for us, you know, America, especially, you know, for our parents, America was the country who protected us, who freed us from all these ugly things in the Second World War and everything was happened, and who helped us out to make sure that we could live in peace. Now it looks like if we have to come to America to help you out, maybe.
So yeah, the first thing that you absolutely must do is create a university-based professorship for anyone fleeing from Texas. Now, so that's the first thing we have to do. We have to have a refugee program for bald, bow-tie-wearing professors to flee their country. Here's what I tell my students who are, even before this administration, but during the book banning and such, which is, we have been here before. If you look back to the 1930s, before the U.S. decided it was going to come in and do all that wonderful stuff, it was xenophobic, it was isolationist, and it was pro, not just Germany, it had a really strong pro-Nazi bent to it. It changed, and it changed for the better, and things got better. But that didn't happen automatically. It took the idea of a concerted effort of people being involved in part of it, right? It takes, for example, a former government leader of the Netherlands, who's now in charge of NATO, to sit in to the most horrific meeting possible with a president to hear all that bad stuff and to walk away and be able to say, did you compare the rational human being to the other one? It takes attention to this, and it takes supporting the the things that support our values and our ethics, right? So the Netherlands needs to support American librarians because they have common cause on information. The other part of this is what we've seen out of this administration is not a show of political power, believe it or not. A really powerful president in our system can't pass laws. They just can't. It's impossible. And they have to get Congress to do that. So a powerful president is one who walks over to Congress and says, here are the 15 bills I need you to pass today. I want to get rid of the Department of Education, et cetera, et cetera. None of that has happened. He's doing it all through these fiat executive orders. And what he's finding quickly is that our check and balance system, in this case, the judiciary, that should be Congress, is saying, nope, wait, that's not how this works. You can't just do that. The question is, will Congress ever wake up and begin to do its job on those factors? So the good news is, while all of this bluster and all of this heat and all of this intentional confusion and discouragement is occurring, there are signs that it has its limits and it's not going to necessarily be ingrained. The problem in having this conversation is that foreign policy is almost always under the purview of the president. That's where he can directly affect NATO and arms grants and really have detrimental effects to international relations. The other interesting part of this is when you look at something like tariffs, right? So now it's time to play the tariff game. Technically, the president can't impose tariffs unless he can find a security or national security interest. So when he implements a tariff, you'll notice there's some language somewhere that more or less says, because America needs to be better prepared for a world war, we need to have our own aluminum and build our own engines and do our own manufacturing because that makes the country more safe. Because if it were for economic reasons or others, technically the Congress has to do that. Now we have a Congress that is sitting back and saying, go, just go, have a good time. But that doesn't have to be that way. We're already seeing some pushback because some of this changes has local effects and constituencies are not happy. So there's already been some metering of that work. The system isn't great, but the system is also built that if this continues and a national focus begins to see different effects, and it's not just one voter in Texas, but it becomes a multiple group, then we have systems in 2 years for elections. We have a system in 4 years for elections. We have ways of getting Congress more energized to work on it. So there's a system here that's working. And what we see is an administration that is pushing on every point to demonstrate weaknesses in the system, but that's still working within the system. There's a lot of discussion about whether he's going to be a dictator and take all this role. To this point, he hasn't. To this point, he's made things that people aren't happy, but he hasn't necessarily gone against court orders. So there's still the separation of powers. And as I said, he hasn't really pushed legislation to do any of these things, which he's going to need. So he's pushing on a system. And then the question is, in 2 years, in 4 years, in whatever it is, will the country sit there and say, what did we learn from this? And what are we going to do about it? And we'll see. And in the meantime, I'm sorry.
Well, we are sorry as well. So whenever you had a chance to go to the Oval Office, sit opposite to Donald Trump,
I would advise him that IMLS is a powerful structure that is having a great effect across the world and is, in fact, supporting libraries of all types that are actually directly helping his constituents, right? A lot of it is his base. Well, his base has a lot of people without four-year degrees, has a lot of people from rural communities, and they are suffering. They are legitimately suffering in this current economic system. Libraries can be part of the solution. We can fight things like deaths of despair. We can actually save lives through libraries. So that's the first thing that I would say. The second thing I would say is when one talks about the legacy of a country and talks about the legacy of a present effect, he needs a society and an institution and a structure to be that memory, like the National Archives, like presidential libraries, like these sort of civic structures of engagement. And these are things that need to be supported. So that's probably would be my message. It's not grand. I know many people will find that message very tame, when in fact it should be sort of, I would reach over and throttle him, but then I get arrested by Secret Service for saying that out loud right. I said throttle. And it's being said, right? It's being said. And that was another point in my thing, which is this instinct of the library community, particularly the institutions of the library community, the IFLAs and the IBLIDAs and the VOBs and whatever, is to make collective statements to indicate collective will, collective disapproval, collective whatever. That's what we do. And as I say, there's a lot of, the more angry Europe is at the United States, the more pleased this current administration is. So I'm not saying don't make the statements. They're important to have. It's important to build common cause. Librarians will read and appreciate those in the United States. And the other last thing is, while this is having such a big effect, and it's right, the United States takes a lot of oxygen out of a room. Let us also remember, in the Ukraine, librarians and libraries are being literally destroyed and wiped off the face of the earth. When we look to the Sudan, when we look around the world, we see oppressive regimes. We see an attempt to eliminate history and wipe history away. And so I am absolutely thrilled if we look at the United States as a starting point to raise the consciousness of what's happening in other parts of the world that frankly need a lot more support.
Would you say, David, that the basis for hope in the next future are the communities?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what this is all about, is the local communities. That's where the healing begins, because we do have legitimate grievance and legitimate difference of views at the very local level. And that's the place where there's the most trust and ability to create it. And if we can create more unified ideas and concepts and sense of direction at the local level, that then bubbles up through all of the systems that go on. It all comes down to the grassroots. It all comes down to how can we have a positive effect on people's daily lives and use that positive effect to then mobilize people to larger, more abstract concepts, right? So not banning this book today will help this child's life get better, which will help this community get better, that will demonstrate how freedom of access helps communities improve and learn, et cetera. So it all starts right with the people who are living right next to you.
And therefore, David, we will not look away.
I think so too. And we will support the librarians, of course, because we are here involved in the community librarian and libraries. So we will support America to keep going, to shout out and to say, well, the communities will work out and will heal, even if this is a time in history which is not very nice at the moment, but it will be better maybe.
And I thank you. I thank you, the Netherlands in general, but I thank you two in particular for bringing attention and all the work you do in educating and preparing those community librarians and giving voice to them across the area in what they do. What you do is important work, and it is things that whatever I can do to support, and I do appreciate the support that you give me. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for this conversation. We're looking forward to your next column on your website. Yeah. And we don't look away, but we will read and we talk.
All right. Well, thank you again. Have a great day and keep up the good work.
Keep up and we keep in touch. Thank you.
Bedankt voor het luisteren naar deze aflevering van De Bieb is Meer. Heb je zelf een mooi verhaal om te vertellen? Neem dan contact op via info@onderzoekmeteffect.nl. De Bieb is Meer is een initiatief van Matt Gubbels. Hij gelooft in de kracht van podcasting en het verhaal van de bibliotheek. Graag tot een volgende keer.